This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Here in this nation of guns, where there are more guns than people. That's right, folks. For every 100 Americans in 2014, there were 116 guns. And that's a trend that has been rising all through the Obama administration.
There have been more guns sold since I've been president than just about any time in U.S. history. There are enough guns for every man, woman, and child in this country. And at no point have I ever proposed confiscating guns from responsible gun owners.
The president has been personally affected by this rise in gun sales. But with a population of 300 million people, it's hard for ordinary citizens to understand what that number of guns circulating means. We're going to take a stab at it, though, with help from some people who study guns in America all the time. The 538 Group, a team of journalists, investigators, and statisticians, after months of research into databases from the Centers for Disease Control, the FBI, and the University of Maryland's Global Terrorism Database, among others, 538 has put numbers and some meaning to the guns in our midst. Ben Castleman is a senior editor and the chief economics writer for 538. He says while politicians and the media like to talk about the gun deaths that shock us and anger us, mass shootings and terrorism, many, many more deaths are happening in the quiet darkness of American homes.
Nearly two-thirds of gun deaths are suicides in this country. Most of the rest are homicides, and a large percentage of those sort of fall into a category of street violence, of urban violence between and among young men. 85% of gun victims are men of one sort or another. You know, we're not going to probably solve the suicide problem by banning guns. A lot of the people who kill themselves with a gun are people who are legally allowed to own them and are probably among the last people who would be asked to give up their guns. It's a very different question when we look at something like domestic violence, where many of the perpetrators of domestic violence are people who are already prohibited from owning guns by a restraining order, and yet we have no effective mechanism to ensure that they actually give up their guns.
Is there low-hanging fruit here? Are there easy, obvious fixes to some aspects of this problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a few things that emerged. You know, if we're going to think about the gun side of this problem, then background checks are one of the things that is sort of most backed up by the research as having an effect. I think then on the other side, we have to look at solutions that aren't necessarily directly targeted at guns, but that look at issues like suicide, that look at issues like urban violence, where guns make that more deadly, but where the underlying problems don't necessarily have anything to do with the guns themselves.
Isn't it curious on the suicide question that background checks will look for a propensity to murder or to commit violent crime, but will never look for a propensity to use violence against oneself, to kill oneself, when in fact there are screening checks for precisely these kinds of suicidal behaviors?
Yeah, I mean, of course, the only sort of background check rules that are even on the table for discussion are rules to prevent people who already are legally prohibited from owning firearms from purchasing them. And so these are generally people who have been convicted of a felony or are subject to a restraining order or for some other reason. You know, there's a whole separate category of sort of whether we need to look at, you know, other markers that might suggest that somebody is at risk.
How does your study give us any insight into police violence against civilians?
In the scope of the gun problem, it is a comparatively small piece. We're talking about 1,000 mostly men killed by police each year, a few dozen police officers who are killed. But it does get at something that is larger here. I spent a few days in New Orleans reporting on their efforts to reduce homicide street crime. And one thing that becomes very clear is that there's not a trust between communities, particularly communities of color in urban environments, and the police. You know, young men of color are overwhelmingly those who die by guns, not by police necessarily, by each other in many cases. But they often don't report those crimes to police in many cases because they don't trust that police will treat them fairly. And so without that trust that needs to exist, it's going to be very difficult to address this problem in any sort of larger way.
Well, then that leads to an alarming conclusion, and that is it possible here that what you've given us a portrait of is not the gun problem, but in a sense, our gun tolerance, that what you've categorized here in very detailed statistical data is, you know, 33,000 deaths a year, we can handle that. If it gets up to 60, that's going to be probably a crisis. But everything that's going on here, we can probably tolerate in America without altering any of our laws and changing what we're doing.
You know, I think that what is disturbing here is that a lot of the categories of death that we're talking about are ones that don't make the headlines, and I think that's part of what we're trying to change here. You know, suicides rarely get attention. There's sort of a sense of, you know, an individual failure or a community failure, but not a sense of a societal failure when so many people kill themselves with guns. Young black men dying in cities is something that really rarely gets attention. We pay attention to these tragic mass shooting incidents, but we don't pay attention to, you know, the hundreds and the thousands of young men who die in street violence. There are 6,000 young men who die every year, two-thirds of them young black men. If there were 4,000, you know, young affluent white men dying in homicides each year, we would absolutely be talking about that as a crisis. We don't talk about it the same way because these are communities that don't get as much attention.
Ben Castleman, senior editor at 538. Thanks so much, Ben.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, here's a story that shows just how the nature of the gun debate in America maintains such an ideological stalemate that even when lawmakers attempt to take up a public health issue like suicide, it's impossible to tell if it's sincere or not. By a unanimous vote in the Washington State Legislature, a measure was passed to try and prevent gun suicides through education and voluntary checks by gun dealers. Approximately 80% of gun deaths in Washington State are suicides. That's well above the two-thirds that is the national average, detailed in the 538 report we were just speaking about. But this initiative may not be completely sincere. A ballot measure that involves mandatory screening for suicide is headed for the ballot this November in Washington State, and it is believed the softer measure is a way for Second Amendment advocates to get the jump on this ballot measure, all while actual suicide victims and their families fade into the background. Alan Gottlieb, founder of the Second Amendment Foundation, is opposed to the ballot measure. He says the voluntary initiative is the best way forward.
Well, we sort of have approached it here in Washington State. The legislature passed the Safer Home Suicide Prevention Act, which created a task force that I'm co-chairman of. And the task force is working to start out with a survey to gun dealers, gun ranges, gun clubs, and gun shows to get their input in what would help work at their end. And we're producing a training video for gun stores to have their employees trained on look for warning signs if somebody might come into their shop to try and acquire a firearm that shouldn't have one, on educational materials, posters, and flyers on how people can get, you know, mental health help if they may need it, and likewise, you know, warning signs on how to safe store a firearm if there's somebody in the home that's at risk. We think it's going to have a very positive effect because nobody feels threatened by the legislation the legislature passed creating this task force. It's real education, and I think it's going to work.
538, that did this big report on gun violence, described the violence as an epidemic. Do you go along with that language?
No, I don't, because quite honestly, they always use this term epidemic, but the data shows the exact opposite. At the same time that firearms deaths are going down, the number of firearms being sold are at an all-time record high. So if anything, you would expect them to go up, but they're not. They're going down.
So the NRA, which, you know, works hard to keep this public health language out of the discussion of gun violence, you would actually make the separation of suicides and call that, which is a majority, you would consider calling that a public health issue.
I think suicide in general is a public health issue. It's a mental health issue, no matter what means is used to commit the suicide. It's not the gun that's the public health issue. It's suicide in general.
Now, if you were dealing with another kind of public health issue, a communicable disease, and the legislation that you passed didn't have any mandates such as, you know, cleanliness, sterility, health department codes, that sort of thing, I mean, would that be considered a serious effort or would that be considered kind of superficial?
there's a difference here. If there wasn't an organized community trying to eradicate people's freedom and their rights, it'd be a whole lot easier to work on these issues. And that's why in other areas of public health, you're able to work on them and come together. And when it talks about firearms in public health, there's a problem because people are trying to use the public health argument to limit people's rights.
Now, isn't it interesting that that's exactly what people who are, as you would say, gun control advocates say about this legislation, that it is, in fact, a preemptive measure to keep something stronger from being put into effect that would result in mandates and, as you see it, start the slippery slope to actual prohibition of weapons?
Well, I think they're saying that because their agenda is one of mandates. Our agenda is one of lowering suicide rates. And we've come together with mental health experts and suicide prevention experts and the gun rights community to actually solve a real problem rather than to push an agenda.
What language, what signal from this so-called other side would tell you that maybe it's time to have a different sort of conversation as opposed to all they want is to get rid of the Second Amendment and them saying all you want is to give people guns at all costs?
Well, the signal we could say would be is one, they'd recognize the Second Amendment, that it's an individual right and that it pertains to your firearms, not just in your home, but carrying for personal protection wherever you might want to be. We'd have to see them back away from a lot of the mandates and pushes that they're doing, which they're not going to do because that's not what they're about. We're going to do it this way, and we're going to show, in fact, that what we're doing lowers suicide rates and that we've accomplished something and that we've saved lives, and let the other side just go on with their agenda that we're going to have to oppose because it mandates things that restrict our rights.
How close have you personally come to this issue, either you or in your family or your friends?
I've had some friends that have contemplated suicide. Thank heavens they haven't gone through with it. And some of the people that I've been working with on this legislation, you know, were gun owners that lost a family member, or one, in fact, was a gun store employee that tried to commit suicide and luckily failed. But it's something that, you know, we're very concerned about, and we'd like to solve this problem, particularly in light of the fact that our opponents have suicide, you know, lumped in with the homicide rates, and they use the homicide numbers to try and scream for why we need more gun control. And if 2/3 of those are suicide and we can lower those suicide rates, it takes away ammunition from our opponents.
Alan Gottlieb is the founder of the Second Amendment Foundation in Seattle, Washington. Thanks so much, Alan.
My pleasure.
If you own a gun, would you consider getting rid of it if someone in your home were depressed? North Miami, Florida. I own multiple guns. I would never liquidate my whole collection because somebody else in my home is depressed. Am I going to get rid of the kitchen knives and painkillers too? And then how do I get rid of all the tall buildings and bridges in the city? You can't make a suicidal person safe by taking away enough objects.
This is Andrea from Hudson, New York. Guns make it too easy to make an irreversible snap decision. A friend took his life this way in February after an argument with his wife. A simple argument coupled with deep depression ended in tragedy. Sure, it may have happened anyway, but with guns readily accessible to him, he had the means to quickly effect his own end. I think of him often, and I wonder what might have been.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.